and I'm walking out and I completely like white it out for the entire thing. Like I walk out on stage and they're like, Strother Games. And then I woke back up and I was like, well, it's done. Like, how did that go?
Welcome back to Every Speaker Has a Story. I'm your host, Dr. Steve Roman, and it's been a while, regular listeners, hasn't it? It's been quite a while since the last episode. I had a rare semester in the fall, and the one thing that fell off the table was the audio recording and editing and producing duties of making a podcast, which if you make the kind of show that I do, where you're editing various stories together, is exactly the amount of work that it feels like it must be. And I just, I couldn't manage it. So, here we are managing again, but in spite of all that, what I wanted to bring to you is a different kind of episode this time around. When I first started the show, I was interested in getting people a behind-the-scenes look, or kind of a backstage pass to what it's like to be a public speaker, what it's like to be in the mind of a professional speaker, how that works, and some of the decisions that you have to make, and those kind of things. And I've had episodes that are about that a bit, you know, technical difficulties and successes and failures and things like that, but I haven't had an interviewee yet who really took us at a kind of micro level about how we operate as speakers, how we feel, how we make decisions. And Strother Gaines, who I met at Inbound, is exactly that kind of interview. So we're going to hear in this episode a half-hour conversation between Strother and myself, and there's a section where I think he takes over and starts interviewing me that really is going to get at some of those questions. So I call this episode A User's Guide to Extemporaneous Speaking, a behind-the-scenes look at improvisation, adaptation, crutching, and authenticity. And I think it will help you. Well, you just listen.
I went to a public speaking conference, I guess like 3 years ago, and I showed up and I'd trained in theater my whole life and had been directing and teaching and acting and sort of doing all of the creative things and not feeling like that path led to a lot of financial success, lots of personal fulfillment, but you know, the sort of starving actor mentality is definitely a real thing for a lot of people. Now, I don't necessarily think that's true or necessary, but we all have that for a long time. So I go to this public speaking conference and we played a game called One Word Storyteller. And it was it's an improv game that I would teach little kids usually. And we played it and the group played it pretty badly. Like it was a pretty big swing and a miss. For me as like an improv artist, I was like, oh, this is, I've done so much better work. You know, I was kind of pretentious about the whole thing. And we finished the exercise and the facilitator, his name was Dan. He says, well, how did that make you guys feel? And a woman raises her hand in the back and she says, I just feel alive for the first time in 7 years, Dan. And I look at this lady and I'm like, oh my God. And I, at first, like super judgy, like I was being a super jerk. And I was like, what is wrong with your life, sweetheart? Like, and but then, like, the more I stepped away from it, the more I've thought about it since that, you know, it's one of those things where people don't get the opportunities that I got as a theater major, as a performer, to express themselves or to play in that type of way. So I started realizing that the skills that I had built over the course of my undergraduate education and my professional life, while having not paid for a long time, actually were super useful and super valuable to others who didn't necessarily grow up in it. And so it was sort of at that moment and at that conference that I was like, I want to start doing speaking because, again, sort of full of hubris. I was kind of a jerk at the conference, you know, full of hubris. I was like, I could do all of this. Like, this would be so great. And I watched all of these speakers who were solid speakers, like good. But I was like, I could probably get up an improv close to that level of engagement pretty easily. And they make $15,000 a speech or, you know, and I'm certainly not there yet, but we're working on the path. And the idea of a really intense sprint and being able to share a message and convey it in such a way that it's accessible to people, all of the sort of things I've done, whether it be hospitality, customer service, theater, storytelling, improv. I was a Segway tour guide for a long time, which actually makes its way into speaking a lot for a company called Segs in the City. I see, yeah, that was...
That did you do it just for the pun? I mean,
I know, right? Yeah, it was. I always say that was my best worst job ever because it's actually super fun being on the Segways. Like, I really enjoy it, and you learn how to like, you know, adapt to people as necessary. So, does this person want like a lot of facts and figures? Does this person want to joke around with me? Does this person not want to talk at all? Like, how do I convey this to, so they're an audience. And so now I've been in front of lots and lots of audiences in lots of different capacities. And speaking just became this really natural lean in for me and my strengths and my experience, which I had never considered as a viable option until that conference.
Man, at a conference, you guys could have like to remove the whole building and just all be on Segways and just work your way through.
Yeah. Come on, everybody. And I take a lot of pride in the fact I was a Segway tour guide off and on like seasonally for about 3 years. I don't know if I should be proud to say that. Like, I don't know the segue, but I was, and I only had two people fall, and both of them were because they just weren't listening. Everyone else, like even the ones who were like, I'm so nervous, I'm never going to be able to do it. Like everyone from young to old could. And the only two that fell was one was a guy who was being a jerk and was like wanting to show off. And then one woman who just like would not listen while I'd be like, here's how this works. She'd just be like, I got it. It's fine. Okay, Susan. Did a great job. So.
Well, it's good because normally your audience doesn't get physically injured as a result of your presentation, so that's helpful.
I mean, no promises, but yeah, that's.
So improv is an interesting thing to take. So, how much of what you do when you're speaking do you still sort of adapt and improvise as you go?
So it's kind of a range. Depends on the client. Depends on the gig. I actually really. For me, I prefer almost a workshop setting as opposed to a keynote. A keynote's wonderful in that you can craft that message, you know exactly what you're saying, you know where you're going, your blocking's on point, everything's very crafted and specific. And in a workshop, I love giving myself that space to play with that specific audience. So you go in and you know like your major bullet points, you know the markers that you want to hit, you probably have some jokes that you do, you have your like standard way of structuring it. But I love that in between where you say, now, like, let me throw it out to you and let's just like dance in that for a little bit. I feel like that's where things get really exciting for me as a facilitator. You know, that's a little bit like, and you blur that line, facilitator, speaker for me, like what is a workshop, what is a keynote, all those sort of things. I try and get as much audience participation as I can. I actually run just recently, now I own a theater company, which has happened in the past like 6 months. And it's an immersive theater company, and we operate in, we create a world that you can live in. And then the performers have to respond to you. You can change the story. Where you go is up to you. Who you interact with is up to you. There's lots of different ways to play with it. And it's in that in-between where people know this isn't scripted and this is just for me that I think people really enjoy that. And I find the same thing happens as a speaker.
So for you, this is exciting. I imagine for a lot of speakers, the whole idea of even any extemporaneous portion would just stress them out. But for you, it's energy.
I feel like it is, for better or for worse, sometimes, and you know, don't tell anybody, but sometimes I'll show up to a gig and be like, let's see where this one goes. Here we go. All right. And I know that's not the like the most, like probably shouldn't throw that out there all the time, but it always goes in these really interesting, cool directions. And it's because I'm open to it being very specific to that person and bespoke to that client or that audience, I think it's way more impactful. Like, trust that you've got the knowledge, trust that you know what you're presenting on, and then really cultivate it to fit what they're looking at. I have, I do Gallup Strength Finder, and my number one talent is individualization. And so for me, like in a keynote, if it's just like, I do this all the time, the same every time, that's actually consistency as a strength. And consistency is my bottom. Like that is my last one. Individualization, make it for the person, make it for this crowd, make it for this moment is where I like to be.
So people listening to this who aren't watching any of this on video, he literally has his Strength Finders framed and he just within reach, he could just pull it down to the camera. Like, of course I might need my framed Strength Finders at any moment.
It's everything. Yeah, I guess what would I show you on my desk? There's not a lot of fun stuff, but that's there. I have, let's see, some artwork.
Oh, that's good.
My postcards from the shows, a lot of unicorn stuff.
Yeah.
There's like people just buy me unicorn things all the time now. But yeah, lots of that thing sits up there. And, you know, it's what we see every day and what we remember. And I do try and frame everything through my strength. And, you know, what foot do I lead with? And it should be the one that I'm really solid at. And that's individualization.
Well, not a lot of people are great at the extemporaneous improv sort of thing. I try to do that. You're probably better at it than I am. And but I find that people really like it better. How does it work for you when you're out there doing it? Do you feel like it works with your audience?
I think it's, you know, that's kind of a speaker's job is to make it feel like that even when it's not. You know, so like for me as an audience member, I should feel like it's just you. You talk like I feel you're prepared. I feel that you're here, that you're present, that you're not just like pulling stuff out of your butt. But I also think that it's important for people to feel like I'm just talking with you right now, and I'm here and I'm present. So yeah, like for me, that's easy because I actually, that's what's happening. But I think for a lot of speakers, that's when you, I think you feel, how do you keep something that you've said 100 times alive and interesting and exciting and engaging for people when you've said it so much? And it's how much do you care about that piece? How much energy you're getting from that group? How much do you want this to land? And, you know, it helps for me to be extemporaneous in the moment, but I still have like the lines that I say, and like that line is the same every time. And that's one of the benefits of having been an actor for a really long time is when you do a 20 show run, you're like, yeah, I don't feel the feelings like I felt the very first time I did this. You have to go inside and find some place to access all of that and bring it out in that moment and not just let it go stale, which is a challenge. I get it.
So the 80th time you give a presentation, this is like an acting skill. This is like, I need to find my emotion, like, because I no longer care the same way I did about this sentence as I did a year ago.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Like dig in, find that, or like change it up. And this is why like the improv experience is really helpful for me, because I can in the moment be like, you know what, this is kind of dying on the vine for me, or I like, they're not really connecting with this in the same way. Like what happens if I explore this thing that's kind of been bouncing around my head? You know, the more you keep your content, the more you keep your ideas just up here and bouncing and circling around, there's going to be stuff that you're like, I thought of that, but I haven't tried it out just yet. So like maybe now's the chance. And being able to veer off and sort of experiment and see what pings and what doesn't with an audience is really helpful.
Okay. Well, as long as we're experimenting, I have to, this is odd. I used to do improv. I was a coach of a destination imagination team for my son and his friends, and they did improv. So second graders doing improv, you can imagine. And their go-to, like, we are out of ideas moment was the call the governor's office, right? So that's how they would solve a skit, is like something's happening, like, well, we need to call the governor to deal with this, right? Like this monster, this whatever, you know, because that was a different kind of improv, because it was like competitive. They had to have this whole story by the end. But we always knew that it was going really badly when they had the call the governor moment. And that was like a metaphor for everything in improv for us later, which was the, you're wrapping up the story really, really stupidly. So there's got to be sort of, I don't know, I'm just guessing that you've had some experiences as a person who's been doing improv for a long time of how do you know when it's not working?
Good question. I mean, oh man, I went to see an improv show on Sunday that was actually really wonderful. I had a couple of friends who were in it. And even as someone who loves improv, I very frequently avoid improv shows, because when it works, it's magic. It's just, it's wonderful. It's so cool to watch people doing it. And when it doesn't work, it's, for me as a performer, one of the most painful things to watch, because you, like, as a performer, I think you watch people and you're like, I hope you do well. I hope you do well. Please let this person do well. Because when you don't, I'm going to know, because this is my world. And it's just like, I can really, like, I instantly transport myself into their shoes right now. I'm like, oh, this feels so terrible. This is the And I think it's, you watch people thinking too much is like an immediate tell when someone doesn't just give something back. It means that no idea came, you've given the prompt, nothing's come through, and they're just gonna sit, and you can feel them digging. And that's when you know, is you start feeling the dig. And sometimes people, like you said, it's really interesting that you bring up the call the governor. And that's just to give your kids like props. That's a high level out. Like that's a really, like, most kids would be like, ha ha, poop jokes. And like that's the end. So like call the governor. I'm going to give them some legit props.
I'm
going
to go tell them that then. I will.
Yeah. Yeah. Like nice work. Cause I've taught kids from like 4 to like, you know, adults, and from 4 to about 37, like poop jokes are kind of, so people just jump. People have crutches, and that's another way. And that's crutches are really good for the first performance and the only performance. So sometimes a crutch for as a speaker would work, where you're like, this is what happens when I get triggered or when I get challenged, I lean into this. Mine is sort of like an endearingly befuddled, like, you know, caricature for me. And like everybody has a sort of crutch to lean on. And if you see someone perform multiple times, so it's tougher when you're just a one-off audience, but when you see someone multiple times and you're like, ah, there's that thing again, you can recognize, okay, that's their default structure, and you can play to the strength. And if it's just a keynote, it's not bad to be there. And it's just, I think it's helpful as an improviser to know what is your crutch and how can I work around it? And what are the types of things that like trigger my crutch and how can I put different structures in place so that hopefully I don't just always go down that singular path?
You seem to me always so thoughtful about all these different levels. So when you're up there performing and you find yourself crutching, you know, there's a part of you that has to be immediately looking out at you going, oh my God, I can't believe you're doing that again. Like, what do you do in that moment?
It sort of depends on how's the audience taking it. You know, like I can in that moment be like, oh, you're doing it. But if the audience is on board and this is the only time I'm going to see that audience, it's like, well, ride that wave and learn from it and do it and figure it out the next time. Yeah. And it really is, there's that sort of concept in improv and really any sort of creative venture is iterate, iterate, keep trying, keep failing. And you're going to screw stuff up. And we resist that failure all the time. And I know that failure is such a like sexy thing right now. And I don't try not to fail. Like you don't want to screw stuff up. But when you do, I don't think you have to beat yourself up because you do learn a whole lot about it. So when you're up there and you find yourself crutching or you find yourself breaking or you find yourself losing your place, then go back and like structure that place a little bit more or figure out like what threw you. Was it that they didn't laugh at the right place or that they laughed too much or that nobody paid attention or you looked down and your primary contact wasn't watching? Like what are the things that throw you off when you're on stage? And then figure out once you're off of it and you're not in that sort of emotionally heightened energy space and you're like sitting at your desk or at home watching TV, like, okay, when I look over at my primary contacts looking down at their phone and they're super not engaged in what I'm saying, like that throws me immediately. So what can I in that moment do? Like, what are things that I can, how can I prevent that from happening? Like, there are all sorts of ways for you to attack it, but knowing what knocks you off of it. So when it happens and you see it, just be like, note for that, and then respond and be with the audience. And that's the number one. And it's tough. Like you said, that extemporaneous improvisation, like a lot of people do not feel comfortable in that. And if you can get to that place, there's a lot of learning that can happen. And it really makes you better in planned material and improvise.
So the last presentation I gave, it was fairly local, so I was driving there. And on the way, on the freeway, the other side of the freeway was being closed down. There was a jumper on the edge of the bridge. What? And there were police there and everything. And I'm driving by and I'm gonna start my speech in like 90 minutes, you know? And so I'm driving and I'm looking at this. I'm like, am I seeing what I'm really seeing here? And in my head the whole time, I'm like, that bridge isn't tall enough. You know, and that stuck in my head. And so I get up to give the presentation and all I'm thinking is I'm seeing her up on this thing, wondering, you know, if they got to her, how it went. And, you know, the thing went pretty well in spite of that, but the whole energy level wasn't what I wanted it to be. And I couldn't figure out how to get myself to another space. And probably that's because I'm not completely devoid of empathy, you know, that I couldn't do
right.
That.
I am a robot. Yeah. You know?
So when it's not a specific moment, you know, when it's just a general, like this day isn't going the way I wanted it to, everything isn't firing the way I want. Like, do you have a more general kind of strategy that you approach to those kind of things?
I mean, for something like that, I might even have just like owned that in the moment. Yeah. You know, that's one of those things where it's like, guys, you will not believe like my commute and what happened. Because it is like, and like I said just a second ago, and I think this is true even in like places where audiences have paid you to be there or it's a more professional thing. Like we as an audience member, we're watching and we are in the back of our mind thinking, I hope you do well. I hope this goes well because you are solving a problem for me. Either I'm bored and I'm being entertained, or you're teaching me a message that's going to help me get better at work, or, you know, you're going to help save my marriage. Like whatever you speak on, like as an audience member, like fingers crossed what you're going to tell me is actually super valuable. So when something like that goes wrong, or if you're like in a weird place, like acknowledging that weirdness and sort of setting it up, like don't make excuses. I don't think that you should be like, you guys, like I saw this thing, so this is going to be a garbage fire. So get ready. But being like, whoa, like on the way here, here's something that I saw. And like, again, to tie back into that improv thing, if there was any way for you to like tie that jumping point, I like, and not to trivialize her experience at all, but like some way to tie that into whatever your message was, where it's like, you know, like I saw this really intense thing, or I'm feeling these really intense feelings. We're human people, you know, we're not automatons in that, you know, we will feel things and we'll have off days and we'll have good moments and bad moments. And, you know, you do your best as a speaker to cover as much of that as you can, but it's also, there's a nice vulnerability piece to it. You know, we talk, Brené Brown's my super professional crush, and she wrote The Power of Vulnerability. And I do think that as a speaker, there's something that's really, you're already sort of getting up on stage and being like, here, look at me. Like, here's, I'm going to stand up here in front of you. And as honest and truthful and real as you can be in that, when you're in those weird places, being able to say like, hey guys, like, had a weird day. Here's what happened. Like, just needed to throw that out there. Like, all right, let's get started. I think that people really relate to that because it makes you feel like, oh, you're here with me.
Yeah.
We're doing a thing. Like, you're not just like doing this again like you did 20 minutes ago or 4 hours ago or 20 days ago. So
it's frustrating because that was my instinct. But at Inbound, where we spoke, I started with a story about something similar. Like, a previous year, my grandmother died the night before I was supposed to give this keynote, and it was really hard. So at Inbound, I talked about that moment because I talk about being honest in yourself and all this. And so at this event, I didn't do that. I'm like, really, I'm up here talking about honesty, and I've got this thing in my head I'm not sharing with them, but I'm like, I don't want to be the guy who starts every speech with, here's something horrible that just happened before. That's not going to feel authentic. So I got all trapped in my head, and it was like, frustrating.
No, I think that's a good brand for you. Like, open every speech with something, and you're like, well, here's something terrible that's happened today. All right, moving on.
They're like, hey, he's a terrible guy. Let's bring him in. Let's do that.
Right, yeah. I can't wait for him to speak.
Hey, let's go. Come on. It's early in the morning. What could go wrong? It'll be fine. Oh, my gosh. Okay, so good. I had a feeling that if I talked to you about that, you would you set me straight.
I got you.
Okay, so improv is awesome and it's cool, and extemporaneous skill is fantastic. When I teach students how to do public speaking, I teach them there's hardly a time you need to memorize a speech. You should just get out there and work with your audience, you know. Don't take them off the cliff, you know, take them where they want to go. Okay, but at the same time, though, you do TED. And my frustration with TED, it was that they really wanted as canned as possible. And so there's that sense in which they develop your message, and the whole process is really cool, but they work on it. So I did it, but I found it initially really frustrating to sort of move into that. So was that similar for you?
Well, my TED experience is very different, I think, than most. I cycled into it sort of backwards. I was approached by one of the organizers, a friend of mine who works with the organizers, and she saw a show that I had directed for the DC Fringe Festival called The House of Yes, and she liked the show, and she said, hey, we've been thinking of having this sort of like immersive theatrical thing for the after party. Would you be interested in directing it? I said, oh, yeah, absolutely. That sounds great. What a cool experience. And then as we started talking about it, they said, you know, maybe you should also speak, but like maybe you should get up and just like forget your lines, and then you'll be like, just kidding, it's immersive theater, pew, pew, and like run back. And I was like, okay, like I could do that, but like it's going to be filmed and it'd be really helpful for me to have this as an actual real footage type thing. Can I actually speak on something that ties to storytelling, ties to immersive, and I'll make it, it won't be like a traditional talk. And if you've seen it, like, you know, at the end, like all of my performers come out on stage and join me in a storytelling exercise, which it was super, super cool. But they kind of gave me carte blanche because they were like, we don't know what you're doing, just do it. So I didn't have to actually like go through the revision process or anything like that with them, because it was mostly a setup for the immersive theater component afterwards. But man, I wrote that one. I tried to memorize it, and everyone, for being so extemporaneous and improv based, like I was like, I can't do that on the TED stage because there's such a timeline. That is my challenge as a public speaker. And if you're listening as a podcast listener, you're like, he talks a lot. I do. And I'll just go. And it's fun, and we'll find the point somewhere in there, and people, and it's engaging. But at TED, it's like, you have 8 minutes. That's it.
Yeah.
So I start talking, and I don't get anywhere near my point. And they're like, 7 minutes, 57 seconds, Mr. Gaines. And I'm like, okay, great, you've ruined it. So I really had to structure myself out a little bit more. And I remember, and this is to say, like, I still get nervous. TED in particular, like, that stage is huge. And I love Sydney Harmon Hall. It's this big, beautiful stage that every performer in D.C. dreams of being on someday. And here I go. Here we walk out. So they're strapping on my mic. And I'm walking out, and I completely like whited out for the entire thing. Like, I walk out on stage, and they're like, Strother Gaines. And then I woke back up, and I was like, well, it's done. Like, how did that go? Like, I went into total just like memorization theater mode in that one. And it turned out really well, and I'm really, really proud of it and happy with it. There are a couple bullet points that I did not get to that I'm like, oh, you missed that. And that was like one of the major points. But at the end of the day, like, it has served me really well, and I'm really proud of what happened. And I feel like I've stretched into something new, and But yeah, the process of not allowing yourself to riff can be a nice challenge. It's sort of the Twitter type thing. Like when you're restricted to how much you can put into something, make sure you're really intentional.
Yeah.
So you watch yourself. Are there still parts of that where you're like, I don't remember saying that, but that's...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was like... I remember walking off and walking back to and feeling really proud of it. And like my cast is all around me and everyone's like, this is so great. It's so what? And then now we're going to perform the show because we literally finished the talk, jumped out, like ran to the venue where the after party was, where we'd been setting up all day to get the show in place and got everybody there. And I was like, all right, everybody plays this. You're doing it. And like went into director mode right after. But I remember walking over and being just like super proud, super overwhelmed, but also like, did I even say that part? Did I say this? Like, I can't remember any of what I said necessarily. It's sort of in and out for me the whole time. Now I watch it. I'm like, okay, like now I've seen it enough. It's sort of that, like when you're a kid and your parents tell you about a memory that, and you didn't really remember it, but now they've told you enough times that you're like, yeah, I remember that. I think that's kind of how I feel about the TED piece now. Like, I've seen it on my reel. I've seen it enough times. And I'm like, yeah, I said that, but I don't. Actual me does not have concept.
Oh, but you know, it's the wireless mic putting on for people. Like, we film our senior thesis presentations for our majors at school. And it's like, people who are confident, they always seem confident. I come up to them with this mic, and it's like, oh, it just got real.
Yeah, no, I'm like strapping it down into my beard. I was like, oh, and I'd had those on before for theater. You know, like it's not like that was the first time I'd ever had one put on me.
Yeah.
But there was something about it. And like looking out at the little red carpet and the TED logo and all that sort of stuff, it was like, woof, here we go.
So aside from TED, tell me about another time when it just really worked, where you had it. It was fantastic. I mean, like yesterday, probably.
It's like every time I speak, Steven. So it's just like it always really works really well. So let's see. I feel like, you know, not because I met you there, but I think that the inbound one was a really nice culmination of a lot of things. I've been experimenting with message. I've been experimenting with topic point and experimenting with, you know, you're certainly not playing a character on stage, but it's the amped up version of you. In lots of ways, and like, how does that connect? And what is strong enough but vulnerable enough? What is funny enough but accessible enough? Like, you're always sort of playing with where is the appropriate level. And the inbound one, I thought, went really well in that I felt easy and confident, and people seemed to respond really well. It was a nice big stage, and it didn't feel intimidating like sometimes those can. Things flowed really well. Afterwards, I got a lot of follow-up from a lot of different people, whether it be for clients, for more speaking engagements, for podcasts like this. It just sort of did everything that you kind of hope it will do. It's a social proofer. It's a legitimizer. It gets you some clients. It makes you some cash. Like, all of the things that you want to get out of that experience happened, and I felt really confident and proud of what went up on the stage then.
Yeah. So when you're in the middle of it, does it like that? Obviously, afterwards, you get a lot of reinforcement so that you know. But I mean, were there things that you were looking for in the moment that were like, okay, this is how I know this is working, that kind of thing?
It's tough because as an artist, you know, when you're trained as a performer, and this, I love my alma mater and I love my professors and everything, and it's a long time ago, but you're sort of always trained to this idea of like your performance was not like, you're a dumpster fire, you know, like what you're doing is garbage and like make better. And it's that striving for better, striving because you can always improve. And so I have a really hard time. It's one of my, like, one of the things I work on with my coach and with my trainers and anyone in my life is like acknowledging like that went well. I have a really tough time with it. I'm like, well, there was this one thing that happened and like, that's what I center in on. And I have a lot of that, it's not really self-doubt anymore, but it's that sort of hyper-analytical, let me pick it all apart. And rather than like focus on the 10 things that went really well, I'm like, yeah, but that, like, you stuttered there a little bit, and that's all that people are going to hear. And so in the moment, it is really tough for me. And one of my other strengths is significance, which I was not thrilled about. It's a weird one, and I won't bore people necessarily with all the ins and outs of it, but significance when underformed is basically like, tell me I'm pretty, like, tell me that was good. I really need you to tell me that was solid. And when it's formed a little bit more, it's about creating work that inspires that feedback loop close. You know, you do stuff that's so impressive or things that are so good, or you work so hard that you can't help but have people be like, nice, I saw that. And that was a significant piece of work. So I'm getting to a better place with acknowledging when things are going well, but in that moment, it's I am not a good mouthpiece for that lesson for your for your listeners right now, because I'm just like, crap, that was garbage. Everything's crap all the time. And then I lighten up and say, like, you did all right. That was fine.
Which is, that's just crazy, too, because, I mean, like, the first, like, so I met you at Inbound, and you're like this, like, tornado of confidence, you know, this kind of, you have this sort of vibe, which is, of course, you're probably, I'm acting right now. Of course you think I'm confident, you know.
But I have a lot of social anxiety, Stephen.
This is my shield. Leave me alone, damn it.
Oh, yeah. No, like, I'm funny. La, 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 la. Like, and then, like, but don't poke too close. Like, that's absolutely it. Yeah. And I get that feedback all the time. People are like, I can't believe that you didn't think that was good. I can't believe. But I think that that's, you know, there's an element of watching all these speakers or people that you look up to, and you're like, oh, they're really cool, and that must be really wonderful. And I would guess, like, 9 times out of 10, most of us are just like, we are garbage people. Under, you know, like, you, that's the message that we tell ourselves. It's just like, oh, that was crap, and this is terrible, and you're never good enough. And that stays with you, and for better or for worse, it's a motivator for me, you know, like, coming from that sort of self-deprecating world does push me to do more, but I need to learn to be gentler with myself. And I think that if most speakers and most performers have something, you know, there's something to the personality type that's like, I'm gonna stand in front of people and say some things, like, I think a lot of us are searching for some of that validation piece where it's like, that was good, right? Did you like that? And if we don't hear it, it's devastating.
Yeah, it's like, you don't get it. It's like, oh my gosh, I'm not getting enough tweets after my speech. You know, that kind of stuff.
You were garbage, Stephen. That's, yeah, like, exactly.
Yeah, get that one. Like, really though? Is this okay? Right. Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. Yeah, because after that one speech with the thing is, I felt the energy level was low, and I was just, like, wandering around the exhibit hall going, like, man, I wish that would have gone a little bit better, you know. And then people were coming up to me and being like, oh, I saw your stuff. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, now I can sort of, like, blossom into happiness again because I got a little feedback from the room. It's just sort of amazing. I think, you know, I have students who feel like this all the time. They're nervous. They hate it, all this kind of stuff. And they're like, I can't possibly be good at this because I don't like it. And I'm like, you know what? Not liking it is the key to doing it. That's how you do it. You
know? Yeah.
And I think they would listen to you and just be sort of amazed, you know, because I think I speak for all of us that we would listen to you read the phone book. And this whole idea that, oh, he thinks he's terrible. My God, if he thinks he's bad, what does that mean about me? And I'm actually literally a schmo, you know?
It's so interesting to watch performers, because I think we all, like, that is a piece for everyone, is just, like, acknowledging that we're standing on stage to get something, and at the end of the day, like, only you can give it to yourself. And it's helpful to hear that validation piece from other people, and you, I think it does move you forward. And I think that's one of the reasons people do get on stage, is, like, for better or for worse, to hear some people be like, no, it's okay, like, you did good, that was good, you are good. Like, there's a, like, we can deep into the psyche stuff in all of this really easily. But I think as a speaker or a performer or as an artist, there is something that's like, I want to share a part of myself with these people. And at the end of the day, like, what I hope for is those people say, we like that, that is good. And hopefully I can take some of that external validation and feedback and internalize it a little bit more. And I do find, like, it is getting easier the more I do it and the more I get out there. But man, the first, you know, even like 32 years of it is challenging, and it's a lot of emotional toil and labor, and I've had a lot of support from a lot of different people that are really wonderful, and I'm so glad to have them in my life. But I do, like, this has been something that helps me get better as a human.
Man, that's all inspiring and everything. Look at that.
I'll flip my hair a little bit.
So you work with people of all ages. You're a teacher. You're a coach. You know, you're a director. So you've got to have some advice for people. So as we sort of, like, close out the conversation a little bit, you know, and kind of go, okay, you know, here's my wisdom for the ages. You got some of that?
God, you know, so I've been asked this question so many times, and I keep thinking I should really, like, write something down. That's a little more pointed, like, what's the thing that I can lead? And I think what I would say, so my coaching company is But I'm a Unicorn, Damn It. And the original name, like, no one, you know, people are like, well, how did you come up with that? That's such a unique name. I'm like, it just kind of just fell out. There's not a good story behind it. But it came to be this sort of idea of, you know, that frustration of, I feel like there's something I'm supposed to do. I feel like there's something that I bring to the world, and it's just not actualizing. So, like, but I'm like, and it's sort of that millennial idea of, like, but I'm really special, right? Like, I'm really unique. I'm a unicorn, damn it. And, you know, I think the way that we figure out what that I forget, I'm paraphrasing this pretty poorly, but there's some sort of like, if we judged everyone on their ability to do, like, if we judged every animal on their ability to swim, then fish would be the geniuses and bears would be the idiots, you know? And like, yeah. It's when we look at the ways that we categorize our strengths and who we are, like, the more we can own our authentic self, and the more that we can put that out in the world, and the more we can share the actual true, like, rumbly bits of ourselves with other people, the more that people relate and the more that people can connect with you. And also the converse of that is the more people will be repelled by it. You know, like, I talk about, like, I do bearded drag all the time, and I have, you know, I'm gay and I grew up in the South, and there are all sorts of things about me that some people would be like, whoa, like, no, don't want to work with that dude. And I have this concept of like, well, bless and release you into the world then, Susan, because I don't need it. You know, I'm going to find the people who connect with the things that are truly me and uniquely me, and I will be as authentic as I can be in every circumstance. Be aware of my audience, be intentional about what I communicate, be intentional about how I show up. But at the end of the day, it should always be based in a core of authenticity. And I feel like as you move into a speaking world, you think about like, well, what's the character that I need to inhabit? And that character should not be too far from who you are. It should be primarily grounded in who you are and what you want to convey to the world, and be that as frequently as you can in as many places as you can and as openly as you can. And for the people that don't like it, peace out, guys. And for the people that do, they'll like you even more for being that model for them, because people like to see people doing that. It makes them feel like they can too.
And that's the show. Before I let you go, two small updates, though. The potential jumper who was perched on the edge of the freeway overpass I drove under to give that keynote in San Antonio, as far as I could tell from my research, I did not jump, which is excellent. Also good news, but decidedly much less important, is that when I got the conference organizer feedback on that keynote I gave, 100% positive feedback, which I wasn't expecting. And so if you take nothing else from our conversation between Strother and myself today, it's that you don't always know how well it's going. And I would say persist, persist, persist. It's usually better than you think. That's not license to just get up there and waste everybody's time, of course, but don't give up. Everything is reclaimable. Everything is fixable. Your attention, your speech, your interaction with the audience, the effect you're having on them, it can always get better in just a minute, a second. So keep at it. Well, thanks again for listening to Every Speaker Has a Story. Hopefully, I won't keep you waiting so long for the next episode. I'd like to thank my son, Sam Johnson Vroman, who is the writer and performer of our theme music. I want to thank Texas Lutheran University for its generous support of this podcast and my time in recording it. I want to thank Strother and all of my interviewees, some of whom have their interviews sitting on my hard drive waiting to be unlocked for the joy of the listeners. I want to thank you, listeners, for tuning in once again to this show. And finally, let me know what you think. Reach out on social media at More Brains with a Z, Twitter, Instagram, wherever you find your social media, and let me know what speaking's like for you, what you're taking away from these episodes, what you want to hear next. I appreciate you listening. Once again, on the second floor in my office in Langner Hall in Seguin, Texas, this is Every Speaker Has a Story. I'm Dr. Steve Roman. Thank you.